the UV completion of Galileans as a concrete example. And in the back of my mind, really had massive gravity and theories like that in the back of my mind, but we can just talk about this at the level of Galileans. And the question is, can we UV complete them? And there's these strong statements. So as I tried to explain earlier, don't take too much credence in the characteristic analysis argument, because we know of theories for which the truncation of effective field theory expansion gives you superluminal solutions, but the full theory doesn't have superluminal solutions. But what is, I think, very powerful is these analyticity arguments, which I reviewed very quickly and then Gregory went through again. Let me just remind you. And the statement is, if the scattering amplitude for a local field theory, well, let me write down the assumption. So for a local field theory, which means at the operator level, the fields commute outside the light cone, which means that these are tempered distributions, which means that the scattering amplitude is polynomial bounded. So S, this thing grows no more than a polynomial, and it's more than that. It's the full, in terms of all the complex, the STs and Us, and so on and so on. Yes. Sure. I'm not mentioning characteristic matrix. This is local field theory. So what? What's your point? The statement of local field theory is the operators commutes outside the light cone. I'm simply writing that statement down. You want me to look at different objects? Yeah, sure. Yeah.
It's still in there. The field commutator also knows about the characteristic matrix.
No, forget about characteristic. I'm just talking about field theory, local field theory, right? Operators commute outside the light cone. Yeah?
The commutator is followed by darkness of tons of points. Equal time.
Come on. Separate the points. Ask, is it zero outside the light cone? Yeah, of course it's correct. Yes. Come on. These are the simple things. We've got other things to argue about. Exactly. For local field theory, this phi shows the light cone. That means the scattering amplitude is polynomial bounded. It also means you can derive a dispersion relation. If the theory has a mass gap, which means the branch cut starts over there, then you can prove analyticity up to the point of 4m squared, which is enough to prove the Poisson bound, blah-de-blah-de-blah.
So the statement that the commutator in real space outside the light cone implies polynomial boundedness?
Yeah, more or less, yeah. Yeah. It was historically proven it comes from this, that's right. From this you prove the just Feynman Dyson representation, and that is the starting point of the proofs of the polynomial boundedness. Yeah. Yes, I know. Yes, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So the proofs are very complicated, and they're all done in the 50s and 60s and so on. But that's the essence of it. So that's the story, and so this gives rise to this statement that there are no. So I ran the argument through for Galileans, that for Galileans, A double prime, so for any theory from these assumptions, you can derive that the M goes to zero limit of a theory with a mass gap is equal to something like the integral of the imaginary part of the amplitude ds, and this thing is positive by unitarity. There's no question about that. And that seems to imply that this thing is positive but non-zero. It can't be zero is positive, but can't be zero because it's a cross-section, and so cross-section is always non-zero. And Galileans, this thing is identically zero. And that rules out the possibility of a local Lorentz invariant UV completion.
So again, remind us, but you said this is for the vanishing mass, but for Galilean or
No, you take the limit. You add a mass, you give it a gap, and then you take the m goes to zero limit. You don't need to take the m goes to zero limit. That's purely a cosmetic way to argue it. The point is that this thing will go like m squared, or some power of m, I don't know, whereas this thing remains finite in the m goes to zero limit, so there's a mismatch. So it's just convenient to take m to zero to prove the argument, right? But the statement has to be made for a theory with a mass gap. Because if there were no mass gap, then the Poisson bound does not apply, and that means that this integral may not converge. So it doesn't necessarily mean that. If the Poisson bound does not apply, it could be that the amplitude grows as s squared rather than s log s at large s, in which case you have to, as I said before, you have to perform another subtraction in the dispersion relation. This thing is, the next one is actually phi because the cubic derivative of this is zero, so you get this condition, and so on and so on. That's right. That's a different thing. Yeah. Right. I'm talking about those things that have been proved rigorously for scalar field theories from the Whiteman axioms, from the statements about local field theories. All this is rigorously proven statements for scalar field theories. Okay. So the assumptions are locality, Lorentz invariance, and mass gap. So as I mentioned earlier, if the theory has no mass gap, then this argument doesn't go through. It doesn't mean that resolves it, but at least the argument doesn't go through. One has to do better than that. Why I say this, though, is let's suppose we're interested in something like massive gravity, where there really is a mass gap. Then we can't rely on that argument, so I'm going to rule that one out as a possibility for this discussion. Now, you can break Lorentz invariance, you can do that explicitly, and then for sure you can get around this problem, but also you pay a big price for that, and I don't want to do that. But as Gregory said, there's also another possibility where this thing gets spontaneously broken, which is to say maybe there are no solutions which are asymptotically Minkowski ever in the theory. And then that would undermine the argument because all this is based on field theory in Minkowski space. So that's a possibility, but that's not where I'm going to go either for that one. I'm going to do the crazy one because we're in perimeter, and I'm going to give up locality. I'm going to say that maybe at some level this thing is the wrong one. Yeah. Exactly the vanishing of that commutator, yeah. So I'm not going to go crazy and add functions of box in the Lagrangian. I mean something much milder where the Lagrangian is local. But I'm going to imagine that this statement is not true. But that does not, the violation of local, so this is not true. But we'll do it in a more profound way, which is to say that this thing doesn't even exist. But what does exist, so let me first go back to that effective field theory discussion. One could ask, so let's take those operators and let me define the following smoothed operators by taking the operator and smoothing with some test function which is localized at the point x naught. Let's do that for a second. And similarly, let's do these two operators. I'll just look at the same operator. Smooth with a test function, and now the same function at y naught. Okay, so from the normal thing, it's clear that if you do such a smoothing process, then the operator at x naught doesn't exactly commute with the operator at y naught at space-like separations because I've smeared now. Remember, in effective field theory, you have to smear at some level because you don't want to take your wave packets to be made out of modes above the cutoff. So we're smoothing basically over the length scale of the cutoff, 1 over L. But that's all. That's all I'm smoothing. But it should still be true that we have causality. So this thing should basically still go to zero exponentially fast as x minus y naught squared goes to infinity outside the light cone. So what, by that I mean, what we've done is sort of smooth the initial source, and then the statement is if we look at the overlap with that with some smooth source here, and we take that in any, so that the central point of that smoothing is space-like separated as it goes to infinity, that exponentially drops off to zero.
Why don't you use local composite?
Right, for local field theory, then that's good enough. But what I'm going to do is give up locality.
You mean that all x itself is no local, because if you give up locality,
yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'm just giving it up. Yeah. So in local field theory, this is an unnecessary pedantic mathematical thing that axiomatic field theorists like to do. But now I'm going to give up locality, which means I can only do this.
So the all of f exists, but they cannot really be written.
Exactly. So I'm going to deal with functions which are not tempered distributions, but are a weaker notion of distribution, where the function f may not be localized arbitrarily, but there are nevertheless are some, but there are localized functions such that this condition can remain true. And this basically rule means there are no superluminalities. So this is how a non-local theory can be superluminal, because what you care, if I'm sat out here, we had this discussion earlier, and maybe I misrepresented myself, but I think I am agreeing with everybody that, you know, if you're far away here, and I've smoothed this over some scale, smoothed that over some scale, nevertheless, it should still be true that I'm not going to see any response from this point here, or at least an exponentially small response, if I'm outside the light cone.
Sure.
which exponential? Yeah, I'm just using the normal statement that, of course, even in local field theory, the operators may fall off as a power law, so it has to be faster than what you would get just from... if you take the operators this way, right, they could fall off as a power. So the key feature is locality as its exponential.
Faster
than a power, yeah. That's... right, that... That's fuzz for me. That's my, yeah. Okay, so that's Poincaré invariant. Yeah. So what I'm going to go for. That's right. Yeah. So this is an old idea, in fact, from the 60s and. In which you basically replace your Wyman functions from tempered to another class of distribution functions, and then you try and construct field theory for that.
So you say that somehow this is. You were saying that somehow this is the only thing we can do in effective field theory because it doesn't make sense to talk about things beyond the capital.
That's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to do something more profound. But that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to do something more profound.
Okay,
but back to the old discussion,
yeah.
I think what I meant to say, and it got lost, is that we should smooth over the cutoff. But nevertheless, it should still be true at arbitrary large distances.
Yeah.
The smooth thing basically commute.
But one can also put an equivalent proposal. Let's look at the chiral Lagrangian compliance. Okay? So it's an effective theory of the top of the analysis. But they can look at operators that interpolate fine states, but that exist also in the field theory, like a Cuba cube.
Yeah.
Cuba
cube is yeah.
The number of the primes. So in that case, that commutator is perfectly well defined in the field theory, as the range outside the light cone, and in the low energy limit, it reduces to fine pion commutator.
Right.
So that's somehow a possible bridge between the low energy effective theory and the UV theory.
That's
you
right.
You should never have to really invoke it.
In fact, that's usually
how yeah.
You do it. That's convenient way to do
right.
It. So there's some exact property in the UV theory, you keep it as exact property in the effective field theory. So in effective field theory, we still calculate correlators of point-like operators. We never smooth them out. We just calculate them approximately. But the fact
right.
that there is a cutoff doesn't prevent us from calculating.
But
since these are perfectly well defined things, we can compute them approximately.
But let's move on, because I'm going to add something where this is the only option. So let me try to explain why this. So it's not that I'm making it up like this. It's I'm led to this from the Galilean duality story. So let me explain a little bit about that. So you're going to talk about the Galilean duality. So let me just review very briefly the Galilean duality from the bigravity perspective, which is where Matteo, who's the unshaven person there, myself got to this. But there's also a sort of coset interpretation and so on. But let me just do the bigravity. So let's think about bigravity for a second, and I'll stick it in field-bind form just for simplicity. Then the action for bigravity. Let me take the minimal model. Let me take the minimal model, which is basically E wedge E, wedge E wedge F, up to possibly a cosmological constant term. We can add that on, I guess. So this is bigravity. There are two field binds. I've suppressed all the indices, but you can put them in at your will. And let's take the decoupling limit of this theory. So remember, bigravity, there is a massive graviton and a massless one. And just like in massive gravity, there's a helicity zero mode sitting inside this, and that helicity zero mode is strongly coupled at the scales below everybody else. In general, it's the scale at which it's strongly coupled is a complicated function of the mass and the two different Planck scales. But let me not worry too much about that, so it's not too relevant for the argument. Let's imagine the Planck scales are the same, and then it's m squared, then it would just be the normal scale m Planck m squared. Now, how do you take the decoupling limit in bigravity? So what I want to do is focus on the helicity zero mode in bigravity, where you just follow what you do in massive gravity. You introduce, remember that bigravity breaks two copies of diffs, diff times diff. So if you didn't have the mass term, there would be two separate copies of diffs acting independently, and the bigravity breaks those two copies of diffs down to the diagonal diff subgroup in which you choose to rotate each Faye bind. You choose the same. And if I'm in first order form, it also breaks two copies of Lorentz down to a single copy of Lorentz. Okay. So what's important in bigravity is not that diffs are recovered, but that diffs are broken, just like in massive gravity. And that means there will be a strongly coupled helicity zero mode coming from that fact, as everybody knows. And the way you introduce you reintroduce the second copy of diffs, and we can do this as follows. So if I follow more or less the massive gravity recipe, I would take what in massive gravity is the reference Faye bind, and then I would introduce a set of diffeomorphism Stueckelberg fields, and replace this by d mu phi a f a of phi, such that in unitary gauge phi a of x is x a. This just goes back to what it was before. But now there's two copies of diffeomorphisms group, two independent copies of the diffeomorphism group. Now, in the decoupling limit, in which you get to Galilean, phi a is xa plus dA pi over lambda cubed, just like in massive gravity. And then there's the vectors, but the vectors are suppressed relative to this, so let's not worry about the vectors, I'll just do the scalars. And that is particularly nice, because then basically f mu a is in the decoupling limit, just becomes this guy. And that is your famous Galilean invariant combination. Okay, because dd pi int is there. So if you take the decoupling limit of the minimal model, at the lambda 3 scale, then, as is well known, but is now manifest in this form, you do not generate any interactions for pi because this thing is linear in pi. So as you take the decoupling limit, the m squared here, there's an m Planck in front, m Planck squared, and you take, so you're also doing e goes to delta mu a plus h mu a over m Planck. So this goes like m squared m Planck, which is lambda cubed m Planck. But you get a one, if you adjust this thing so that this thing has no tadpole, which basically means that it's of that form. And then in the limit, you get from this 1 over m Planck, that cancels that m Planck, and you get lambda cubed h mu nu d mu d nu pi. And now because we're in the decoupling limit, we don't need to make a fuss between the difference between a diff index and a Feuerbein index. They're basically the same. And that's what you get. And no, plus no interactions. and the gravity parts do the same story. I also have to take the decoupling limit for the reference metric because I've set the Planck masses to be the same. Oh, let me send one to zero faster. Wait a sec. Maybe I'm being too quick. Anyway, the point is that no pi self-interaction. That's right. Which means that the decoupling limit is a free theory. Okay? Pardon? With no vectors. Yeah. Forget the vectors. Pardon? It's infinity in the limit. No, I'm just set them to be the same, just for simplicity. So the point is, in the decoupling limit, what happens? Paralleling the mass of gravity case is that you get a Galilean. Well, you don't get a Galilean. You get something that would be a Galilean if it had interactions, but it has no interactions, and is actually just a free theory. And so post-diagonalization, you get just d pi squared. And I'm skipping through the details, and you also get the second spin too much. So that's everybody knows that. That's the standard story. But in the bigravity, what is interesting is, of course, if I just it's still bigravity if I switch E and F around.
Are there interactions separated by lambda?
No, there's none. Oh, they're vector ones. Forget the vector. No, it's zero. It's from infinity. It's a free theory in the lambda 3 scale. If you forget the vectors. but that's not this is a motivation to the I'm not going to use that theory. This is a motivation for the duality. Okay. Indeed, for this theory, there are still vector interactions at scale lambda 3. That's not my point though. So I can now switch E and F around. And the point is that I could have said, well, I actually had a lot of freedom in how I introduced the second copy of diffeomorphisms. And I could have, instead of introduced them on F, I could have introduced them on E. Right? So now I could have introduced a second field. It will be a different field. Let me call it psi. And I introduced that on E. And of course, I can do this. There's a clear symmetry between A and F. Would give me a different answer. Now, what is interesting is now you look at that theory and say, well, now if I do that, and now I do psi a goes to psi a, and take the decoupling limit, this is xa plus dA, and now I should call this a different field, I'm going to call it rho over lambda cubed, then unlike when I do it on F, in terms of E, this is nonlinear, which means I will get things that look like interactions. Okay, so explicitly, I'm going to get something like, if I take the decoupling limit of this, I will get stuff like H mu nu. And then basically what Lashi wrote down earlier, there's a dd rho term, and then there's a dd rho squared in, with the epsilon structure and blah, 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 and a dd rho cubed. And you get something like that. And so this now looks, this course fake looks like it's an interacting theory. And indeed, when you diagonalize it, then, yeah, okay, sorry. when you diagonalize it, you get for rho, killing off the spin two parts, you get a naively interacting theory whose action looks like something like 1 plus box rho, so it looks like a Galilean, plus dd rho squared, the normal Galilean combination to the 6, plus dd rho cubed, etc. And then there's a dd rho to the 4. And this is just a quintic Galilean model with special coefficients. So taking the decoupling limit one way gives you a free theory. Taking the decoupling limit another way gives you a quintic Galilean model. But clearly, these are the same theory, right? Because we started with bigravity, and we just chose to put the diffeomorphisms in a different place. In the upstairs theory, all we did was a diffeomorphism to go between these two pictures. Essentially, that diffeomorphism and map is that this transformation, the psi A, is the inverse of the phi Stueckelberg transformation, i.e. that psi A of phi is XA and vice versa. I think I've got that the right way around. But you get the idea that the two are inverses of each other. So one can do, in the bigravity theory, one can do a diffeomorphism to go between the two. And the two theories have to be equivalent because they're just a diffeomorphism away from each other. And there are no known diffeomorphism anomalies in 4D that I know of. And so we normally assume that the diffeomorphism invariance is kept intact. So these theories are equivalent, yet the decoupling limit theory looks different. This looks naively interacting. But of course, this is not interacting. It's actually a free theory. And one can check this just by doing scattering amplitudes. You can just do the normal story. You could do the normal. If I went to do 2-2 scattering from the cubic Galilean, then we would have to have an intermediate contribution, stuff like this, normal story. But there's also this piece, which just gives you a direct thing like that. And what happens is when you sum all the tree-level amplitudes together, you find 0, confirming that this is indeed a free theory. And that goes at loop level. One can then do the analog at loops, and you find indeed that the theory remains free, up to counterterms, of course. So the statement is that this theory, which is the free theory in terms of pi, is equivalent both classically and quantum mechanically, at least in perturbation theory, unquestionably. You can just do the loops and you see there's a counterterm to this theory, which, to cut a long story short, packages into this particular combination, plus counterterms. And this is actually normal in the equivalence. When you use the equivalence theorem between different theories, it's really only, of course, it's only up to the statement that of counterterms, because although physical things don't change under field redefinitions, counterterms do. You know, if you use a particular prescription, it will be different depending on field redefinitions. And of course, the essence is that these two are the field redefinition away from each other. And what is that field redefinition? It's just the decoupling limit of the diffeomorphism here, and that decoupling limit is, let me write it out for you. So essentially, I just take those formula and I write the decoupling limit formula in, and it is the following. So let's think of x the coordinates in which the field pi is sitting, and x tilde is the field is the coordinates in which the field rho is sitting, just for convenience. Then essentially, it's a diffeomorphism between these two coordinates. And the inverse of that diffeomorphism is this guy. And this basically, these relations define the field pi in terms of the field rho in a non-local, in a in an implicit way, not an explicit formula, but they implicitly order by order in perturbation theory. One can invert those formula, and this is what we call the Galilean duality. It's a classical duality.
Yeah, but even classically, I mean, you always have a strong coupling. I mean, electromagnetism without charges, it's a bit trivial. It becomes more interesting when you have charges, because there you see that.
Right. That's not true for all of them. There are weak dualities as well. Yeah. But
what do you mean by duality? Establish the first theory, you fulfill the definition, you get the analysis theory.
That's right. Which is also free. That's right. It's a free theory. Yeah. So we can call it what we want. That's it sounds fancier, exactly. It's good to write on the title of a paper. And you can also you can view this from the coset construction, and it's just a choice of different representation of the coset. But anyway, the point is that you can show order by order in perturbation theory, the tree level amplitudes are the same, the loop level amplitudes are the same, up to counter terms. This is easy to do. Yeah. Nothing particular, but if you take a generic theory and you do field redefinition, you'll get something that looks entirely ugly, right? Yeah. But this, whereas I've given you one example, the point is that this maps all the Galilean theories into themselves. So that means that two naively distinct-looking Galilean theories are identical.
So you see this, the non-trivial aspects appear if you go beyond the minimum.
Yeah, I just maybe that's my all. This duality holds for all Galileans, and it maps different Galileans into each other. I just gave you this example because this is the example that I'm running with. Why am I running with this example? Because this theory is UV finite. It's a free theory, right? So as obviously the S matrix is trivial, nothing to say. So this is UV finite. This everybody agrees. Come on. If you use the perturbative description for this theory, then unitarity is not broken at any scale. I think we can agree on that, right? Okay, great. That's right. So similarly, this one, if we use the perturbative description for this theory, then unitarity is not broken in any scale. I think everybody agrees with that. And generically, this maps Galileans into each other, and the same is true that the two are just different field redefinitions for you. No, so it is sort of just a field redefinition, but that would sort of makes it sound too trivial because it's a very non-local field redefinition. And in particular, even without adding external sources, it's easy to show, of course, as we all know, this thing is only luminal. If you look at around any on-shell configuration, the fluctuations of this are luminal. But as is well known for the Galilean, I can even construct, for this theory, I can construct on-shell configurations. So I don't need an external source. I don't need the Weinstein mechanism. And I can make it that the fluctuations of that theory are superluminal for on-shell configurations without external source. Everybody agree with that? I thought I might get. No, okay.
So what happens? I mean, this is a classical dualism. So what happens to the measure of the?
It's quantum. In perturbation theory, it's quantum.
Okay, so you're saying at the level of Feynman diagram. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, if you drive the passive signal for this, is the measure invariant?
The measure is never invariant under a field redefinition, but what you get from the measure is terms that contribute to the counterterms. So precisely the reason you have to add these counterterms is to make that equivalent. But these come from the measure.
So those counterterms hopefully involve more derivatives.
That's right. So in field theories, doing the measure, it always gives you an infinite contribution. And these are just a part of the counterterms in the theory.
And they're choosing
such a way
that the estimate
remains. That's right. So I'm choosing the measure over here to be 1, and then I'm making the measure here such that that will equal. Of course, if I choose a different measure over here, I could choose a counterterm which was infinity minus a finite amount, and then what I would be doing is adding over here, you know, a box row to the 10, for example, and then, of course, there would be an interaction here. So it's certainly true that it's only true for a given choice of measure that two things are equivalent. But this is always true for equivalence theorem statements. That's always what you mean.
But we really define the draw theory by measuring the theory.
That's right. That's right. Usually, yeah. usually in DIMREC, I would say that the local counterterms vanish from the measure. And I think that's true here as well.
But you might have some.
I forget the story, but there's a paper in which people did this to one loop. The Czech guys did it.
Let me make my comment. You will find this some free theory. Okay. Now it's going to the same background.
Yeah.
So somehow, when you talk about this as raw theory, it looks like you're interested in calculating correlators of raw theory. But of course, if you translate now with free theory language, then this raw field produces like elementary field in that as raw theory. From free field language, it's some complicated, horrible, non-local operator.
That's true.
Just the fact that you're doing calculation with free theory does not guarantee that object is well defined, right? Because at the end, like every question about interacting theory can be formulated as a question.
Well, that's what I'm going to calculate.
Okay.
So that's exactly how we just do it. So we're just going to do it. Right. Okay. So what I'm going to do is define the theory over here. So that is my theory. And define the theory over here by just the map between the two.
And let's just again, forget about the throw up for the square.
Yeah. That's right. So really what I'm doing is constructing operators in the free theory for which those operators in the classical limit would satisfy the Galilean equations of motion.
And it's not at all guaranteed that this operator will be well-defined object for free theory.
That's right. In fact, at some level, they won't be.
Yeah.
So, but I'm just going to calculate them. So then we can see. We do.
This has to be connected to some physics.
Yeah, you can do this duality for the whole standard model if you really want to in the Higgs field. yeah, it preserves gauge invariance. Yeah, it preserves gauge invariance. Gauge invariance? Yeah. Yeah. But if one theory is gauge invariant, the other one will be. But the gauge invariance might get. You can also do a map on the vectors. You can do an analog of the duality map on the vectors in which you map a theory in which the gauge invariance is linearly realized into a theory in which the gauge invariance is non-linearly realized. But that's another story, and I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
Anyway, so what I'm going to do is really define my row as operators acting in the free theory. So my theory is free, there's no question about it, and I'm really constructing operators for which, in their classical limit, will satisfy the classical Quintet-Galilean equations of motion. And that I'm going to define as my quantum theory of the Galilean, because no one else has a definition of that, so that's what I'm going to count as the definition here. And how do we do that? So, wait a second. Now I've forgotten. wait a second. Yeah. I'm going to do it the other way around, just to be awkward. I'm now going to switch pi and rho, because that's the way I always think of it in my head. No, maybe I can... okay. No, I'll stick with this. Okay, fine. So the way I'm going to do this is as follows. So in perturbation theory, there's no problem iterating this in perturbation theory, expanding out in powers of 1 over lambda cubed. But of course, when these are operators, which we're now going to imagine, there are operator ordering issues, right? It becomes ambiguous when you do that expansion. And those operator ordering issues are tied to the counter terms in the theory. So there are not a unique answer, but the idea is to choose a particular answer which corresponds to a particular set of counter terms that will preserve the UV finiteness and the respectability of what we got. So we see what we can do like that. So let me before I get to that, let me just first think classically. If I have a field rho, I can write that as a Fourier transform. Of rho of k, and then I can write that as an inverse Fourier transform. Let me have an integral before y, e to the minus ik dot y of rho of y. Okay, pretty straightforward. And now what I'm going to do at the classical level, before I get to the operator, at the classical level, I'm allowed to perform the duality map inside this integral and map it back to pi. And doing that, so let me think of, consistency of notation. Let me just relabel those tildes. And then I want to map it back to the y's. So y tilde is then y plus d pi over lambda cubed. And then from this thing, I'll get a measure, which ends up being the determinant of 1 plus d d pi over lambda cubed e to the minus I k dot y plus d rho y. And then this thing, for a relation I haven't written down, this thing is basically, I've forgotten what it is. It's something like pi of y plus d pi of y squared over lambda cubed. Yeah, I think that's it. Okay, rho of x is equal to that. So that's what the duality map is. Now, in the back of my mind, I'm still sort of thinking that this is equivalent to what you would get just by doing the perturbative iteration of these equations. Of course, it is. Yeah, so let me write it out again. Oh, I'm sorry, it's pi there. Yeah, so let me write that out again. So what I'm going to do, so just classically, it is true that that rho is equal to this integral so with some junk, some extra junk here, I could have packaged together with it. Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is why I wanted to do it the other way, but never mind. So classically, that's just true. Again, it matches the perturbative expansion. And remember that pi is, we want to quantize this, so I want to stick hats on everybody, so that these are operators. But there are ordering issues. And so one has to choose some ordering, which is corresponds to this infinite number of counter terms in defining this operator. So I'm just going to do the old cherished ordering of doing normal ordering on this operator. So I'm now going to replace, basically what I'm going to do is define an operator, because I can, I mean, I'm writing that. There's no point doing this, right? That's stupid.
Complete by something. You said that measures for local filler definitions can be after the counter term, but this is not a local filler definition.
Yeah, but perturbatively it is. Perturbatively it is. So in perturbation theory, I can add a perturbative set of counter terms, order by order. So I only said the theory was equivalent order by order in perturbation theory. I was careful.
This measure issue, in the bimetric theory, you have an integration measure with G and F, two matrices. How do you define those measures? They're both independent on that. If you define the measure.
Yeah, in the decoupling limit, those things don't matter though. Right?
If you integration measure with G and F is separately the motion of the invariant, then you will never see these recovered modes.
No, but you get them because once you Stuckelberg them, then you've got a gauge theory, then you have to add gauge fixing terms and Fadio Papageorgiou or whatever you have, because gravity is more complicated. But that you get from the measure, you'll still get that story. In the decoupling limit, though, it's straightforward. Yeah. Yeah, sure, but you always have to break that and add the ghosts, and it's more complicated than that. Yeah, it's more complicated than that, right? And even for gravity, even we don't know the measure for gravity.
Right?
Yeah. We remember that we in the decoupling limit, we're effectively putting ourselves. Extended the gauge group. That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Why would I have to do normal?
Yeah, like if you were not
seeing the rules of the game.
I'm making the rules up.
Okay. But
so,
when you're expanding pi there, it's going to be termed with even number of pi's and those with odd number of pi's.
That's right.
Because with the odd numbers of pi in normal order, then you're not going to end up with an omission operator. Or you have integer A.
I'm certainly doing it in a way that's a mission. Trying to think what's
already at the most level without normalizing the terms, so that
yes.
Even the dimension 4 terms, so modeling is not sufficient to define the operator, but also have wave function normalization.
In this case, it is sufficient because it is a free theory, remember. So there's no actual.
That doesn't matter. You take a theory, take a theory that lambda 5 and 6, right? That's a non normalizable theory. So lambda is actually the source for the operator 5 and 6. So you can compute perturbative in lambda and get correlators of pi. You can think it to get correlators of pi 6. So to define that theory, you need an infinite number of counter terms that are normalizable. So even a free theory, even a normalizable theory, and a priori,
but this is a free theory. It's still a free theory.
If you add a non-normalizable operator to a free theory and try to compute its correlators, and the only way in which I really know how to do it is to, you know, add sources in the Lagrangian and then compute the partition function and then take derivative with respect to the source perturbative. Then you do need to resolve ambiguity that comes from the fact that when operators collide, you
you have singularities, so you need to renormalize. You have an unrenormalizable theory, you need an infinite number of tensor theories. That's anabolic.
I agree there's an infinite number, yeah. Yeah.
And that's
right. No, no, yeah. I'm absolutely in, yeah. Yeah.
So, the normal order is just the beginning of
Well, I'll be able to get everything finite from this. So, in this case. It's still a free theory. I'm not adding this in as an operator.
In a free theory, you can compute, say, pi to the sixth point x, pi to the sixth point y, etc., etc., correlator, right? I mean, don't you need to define what you mean pi to the sixth? I mean,
you want to add that as an irrelevant operator to a free theory, that's what you're saying?
Yeah, because that's, I mean, when you compute, if you take the generating function.
I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, you're following, I agree that's the standard composite operator renormalization story. But I'm not actually adding this in the generating function. I'm just going
to
compute this quantity.
You don't have to add anything. Point splitting. Let's say you point split that example. Right? So certainly there are divergences, and you remove those divergences.
You just subtract those
divergences. Actually,
yeah, but it's not the same as the normal order, right? So,
not necessarily the same.
So if you just did normal order and try to calculate endpoint functions, normal order operators, generically you will count the new divergences, and you need to provide a description of how to. Just to say normal ordering for operators itself is not enough to define this.
But do you agree that if you do normal ordering and you find that it's finite, then you've justified post hoc that you were able to use it?
But
and the likely origin of that is that it started from a free theory?
No, I just don't believe that this would be the case.
I just wanted to be part of the
idea. I mean, when two operators collide and get close together, then you have some extra divergences that you have to take care of. In particular, if you want to use any of these operators to determine some commutational relations, some algebras, some charges, God forbid that you want to integrate this row over space-time, or object obtained with row, because then you will have to tell me what happens when two operators collide.
Yeah, because
then that will define, we need another set of subtractions.
Because
that happens even for a free theory in two dimensions.
But here it's much more complicated, yeah. Right? Because here there is already there, there is, people can say, oh, let's calculate the parameter separate points.
Mm-hmm.
But here there is integral d4y, so
yeah.
Necessarily when you take a two-point function,
you will have, then the only way to treat that is to do the usual shebang of a normalization of a non-normalizable theory, which requires an infinite number of counter terms.
The process is over a sort of anomaly, right? Yeah. So you just do pre-series calculation, calculating two-point function.
I don't see why I'm supposed to believe that something that does not work for a free theory in two dimensions works here.
I think this is going to show you.
let's just do it. Let's just do it.
No, but just the point is saying that it's free theory.
Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, doesn't mean anything here.
Yeah.
So
that's the point. I mean, unless you tell me how to regulate composite operators, right? Especially composite operators, and also you have to tell what happens when you have to tell what is the OPE, right? So what happens when two operators collide?
Yeah. Okay. So let me run with it. Maybe it'll become transparent. Because so let's suppose I wanted to calculate this thing now, right? Okay. This thing, but order by order in perturbation theory. By that, I mean expansion 1 over lambda cubed, is finite, order by order. There are no extra divergences.
Why?
You can just show it. It's true.
I don't believe it, because you have an integral in D4R. Why?
It's
true. You see, this. So you say that order by order, actually, this is a local Fiedler definition?
Yes. Order by order, it's local. It doesn't look local, but order by order is local, right? So order by order, it's just, I don't know, I'm just making it up now, but it's pi plus d pi squared.
But that's finite as long as x is not equal to y. Right? So you are missing all the...
Yes, no, that's right. That's right. I'm not disputing that fact. I'm not disputing that.
So you cannot use that to compute, say, integrated charge.
So it goes like... Maybe this will be, maybe this will make it clear. Just on dimensions, it starts like that. And then, of course, it has to go like 1 over lambda 6. So it goes like that, et cetera, et cetera. So order by order, it's an expansion in 1 over lambda 6, x minus y to the 6. Right? What else could it be?
Plus delta.
Plus delta?
Plus contact term, sorry.
He's not trying to...
No.
It's just
x not equal to y, right? So yeah, x not equal to y, yeah. This resummation, though, does not converge. So it doesn't exist in real space. I'm going to say an even more profound thing, right? So this is not... I'm not even going to do a composite operator renormalization because I'm saying this is not even a local field theory. This operator is not local.
And this, moreover, not even the contact... The contact terms, when you resum them, they resum to non-local terms.
Right. This is. If we're saying that this is not local, and that's what I'm saying.
No, I'm saying that it's not defined.
Order by order, it's fine. I agree. It's not defined. This is not defined. Absolutely.
Yeah, but then you agree with what we were saying before, right?
Right. This is not defined. Okay. But its spectral density is defined, and that's the point.
But why I should be excited about this?
No.
How is it better saying that, okay, I have some field theory which is unrealizable, I don't know how to apply final integrals, but integrals are not defined, okay? So...
Let me get to the point. If you let me get through it, it'll become clear. I think we all agree on the actual math, but let me get to the interpretation, what I'm going to say the interpretation. So what we can, so if we formally, order by order in perturbation theory, order by order it's finite, and we can write this in terms of its spectral density, normal story, some spectral density, Kalman spectral density, with, you know the formula, right? Something like that. What?
The free propagator.
Yeah, free propagator, yeah, sorry.
This row is different from that.
Weidman function with mu. Right, so order by order, I can compute the spectral density, and just by looking at it, what it is...
I don't understand how you can write that, because a row could be a polynomial, it has an ambiguity that's polynomial in mu, right?
Yeah,
I mean, the spectral density defines this two-point function. You could do the integral on x, right? And get rho just by integrating and exchanging the two integrations. Now, this means that actually when you write a given rho, you are also defining this two-point function at coincidence point. You are giving a prescription for the delta.
Right? I'm sorry.
So you're going on the spectral density of the field?
No, I'm talking about the spectral density. Once you write this the formula with rho e to the I kx, right? When you write the Chanel-Lehmann representation, you are actually defining your two-point function, but also a coincident part. And the ambiguity is in the definition of the spectral density rho. Right? So you do not know rho, right? You have to tell something about how you the divergences.
But you're saying ambiguity is polynomial in mu squared.
Well, I suppose that you have to tell something about the behavior of infinity of this row, right? Which is exactly what happens when the two operators collide. I mean, everything is still defined here. That's the problem. I mean, but you have two sides of an equation, and neither left, neither bottom, right.
But that will be my point, that this thing, this is not a local, this is not a local operator. But these things are well defined. I can calculate them, they're finite. Okay, these coefficients. I can write this thing as a sum. And with my choice of normal ordering, it gives me a specific choice of that particular coefficient.
So why I should care about those coefficients?
Let me go.
Just a bit of that, what you mean by mu is what's usually called mu square, meaning is the invariant mass square?
I think it's more common to call mu, but yes, that's the one, yeah.
So invariant mass square?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's lambda 6, the n, mu to the 3. If you want, okay, if mu is the mass, I can put 6 in, that's okay. Plus the delta function associated with the leading order guy. Now this series is actually convergent, and this gives you an entire function, which is a hypergeometric function. And the asymptotic form of this hypergeometric function is e to the, let me use mu as the energy, so it's e to the mu r star of mu. So remember that mu is the energy, and r star is the Weinstein radius. It's the Wyman function, free Wyman function. Yeah, I'm remembering I've made the Wyman function as well, not the Feynman propagator. That's important.
It's the
Weinstein radius.
The actual expression.
Well, the actual expression for a 4D, four-dimensional Galilean is the Weinstein radius written in terms of the energy of the Galilean. So you're probably more familiar with seeing the m to the third expression, whatever it is, with the mass of the source. But if you compute the energy of the Galilean field that creates, then the Weinstein radius is mu square root of, I've shifted, right? So mu is the energy, mu over lambda to the 6/5. But 1/5. Beg your pardon, 1/5.
That's not power lambda.
That's right. So it's what Geer would call the classicalization radius, but it's really just the Weinstein radius.
Units of lambda or units of mu?
I'm sorry. Yeah. In units of lambda, it's mu to the 1/5. So now we'll see in fact, there's no contradiction between the left-hand side and the right side in the sense that neither, indeed, this thing grows faster than a linear exponential in energy, which means I've erased it, but if I were to try and compute the real space Wyman function, if I have a spectral density that grows exponentially faster than a linear exponential, then the integral does not converge because the Wyman function itself only falls off or oscillates exponentially. So as promised, this is indeed infinite. Such fields whose operators have an exponentially growing spectral density were considered back in the 60s by Jaffe, and these were called non-localizable fields. And so these are fields which are well-defined in momentous space. Their spectral densities are finite. Any order, any endpoint correlation function in momentous space is finite. Order by order in perturbation theory, you can calculate it. The sum of perturbation theory is a convergent expansion. It is not asymptotic. It's a convergent expansion, not an asymptotic expansion. And so you really get an entire function, and the entire function of all endpoint correlation functions grows exponentially as mu r star, where r star is the Weinstein radius in the system. So what is rather nice is you see something about the Weinstein phenomenology coming out in this otherwise would-be free theory. The quintic Galilean operator, this operator that we're describing that describes the quintic Galilean field, knows something about the Weinstein radius in that system. So whilst it is true that this thing does not exist, which means these are not tempered distributions, which means that you can't construct operator product expansions, there's no longer a well-defined OPE because that assumes a finite number of divergent pieces, which you get for a tempered distribution, which is tied with the polynomial boundedness of the scattering amplitude, yada, yada, yada. But you can smooth these things with test functions, like we said before, at two different points. Provided these test functions fall off sufficiently fast, this thing exists and is finite. So
how that this follows from that? You mean at each point x and y, this two-point function is infinite?
Remember these things are always distributions. So the actual at a given point, yeah, this is infinite. But if I smooth them with a class of test functions, which is not the class you allow for tempered distributions, but it's called these things, Gelfand, Shelov, I have no idea to say that, but distributions. So you change your notion of your class of test distributions, which relates to the paper you were mentioning. On that space of distributions, the Wyman functions are finite.
Yeah, but I thought that that was, doing the smoothing was a way of regulating the singularity of the distribution of x equal to y. But
that's exactly right.
If x not equal to y, you're saying that w is still infinite.
No, this is finite.
No, but the line above.
This is infinite, yeah.
For any x and any y.
That's right.
So you compute something that doesn't have, it's strictly infinite.
That's
for
right.
Any value of x.
That's
and
right.
Y.
So that's what these.
That's not like a delta function because it.
That's right. That's right. These are not tempered distributions. There's a weaker notion of distributions which don't have in that space of the test functions used to define those distributions. There are no test functions of compact support. That is why you can't define the fields at two different points. Okay, so a completely different notion of distribution.
What kind of functions are these? These
are, you can look them up. It's good. So basically, the functions in momentous space have to fall off to compensate this exponential growth. And so what does that mean in position space? Basically, in position space, wait a sec, I should know this. It's
Is mu k squared there or k there?
I'm sorry, give me a second. In position space, it's x to the 6/5. X over lambda 6/5. So it's the class of test functions whose asymptotics fall off exponentially as x over lambda to the 6/5. And that 6/5 is just the Weinstein scaling. Remember that R star
at large X.
Yeah. Oh,
sorry, but usually, yeah, UV behavior in momentum space maps to differentiability properties of the fluid as well.
That's right, but this is non-local, so there's an IR UV mixing.
So is mu energy S squared there or energy?
Mu is energy. I switched
mu
to energy.
Mu is K, absolute value of K there. Is that the
Yeah, mu is the energy in the spectral density. Yeah.
So your Gaussian would do it, but Gaussian is.
Gaussian would do it, but Gaussian's too strong.
But that's fine. I mean, that's good enough.
Yeah. But these distribution spaces, which you can look up, they're defined by the minimum fall-off rate needed to define this. So this is called, this space is called S6/5 or something. So it's a Gelfand-Shelov distribution. So what these are, these operators make sense. As not as tempered distributions, and because they're not tempered, you can't have an operator product expansion, which is consistent with everything we've been saying about composite renormalization. But they do make sense in a different distribution space, a space that was considered back in the 60s. But it's non-local. It's non-local in an extremely mild way, in the sense that I'm not sure, but But that's what it is. And so any endpoint function for this operator is finite and will have finite, when smeared with appropriate distribution, will have finite correlation functions. And so,
And then we care about normal operators because they correspond to some observable thing, right? So let's say, here we're talking about free theory. So let's say we've got some spin system which produces the free theory at this limit. So what measurement should they make to measure these kind of things? What kind of probe they should introduce to see these objects?
Well, you couple a matted locally to the field rho of x, where rho of x itself is a non-local operator. Right, so.
But just to get an idea of how crazy they should be, right? So, we talk about operators, people do measurements. The correlation functions respond to something which you run into when you do measurements. So you can get a feeling how useful these objects are. So what kind of measurement they should do condensed matter system to get.
Yeah, I mean you can still measure the correlation function, right? By something.
But my thing of the ideology is that you're taking this as a proxy for a more general Galilean field.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah. So then the story, this is one theory. What I'm going to say, my argument is that if this already has to be done for this one, and remember there's no cutoff here, that all Galilean theories fall into this class, not just this one. This is just the fact that this is the one I can actually do a calculation for, the rest I can't. And that sort of gets us around the whole absence of UV completion story, although one has to check why. But once you give up locality, you give up all the things that you use to drive the analyticity and yada, 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 Poisson bound and all that. And so one has to go through and do this again. But there can still be an S matrix for these theories. It was proven that you can still write down an S matrix for these theories back in the 60s. Right? This theory is free. In the generic case, what I'm saying is the generic Galilean are not tempered, the operators are not tempered distributions. They are Gelfand-Shelov distributions. And it was proven back in the 60s that such operators can still have an S matrix that satisfies cluster decomposition and the usual kind of crossing symmetry and the usual kind of things. So I've gone way over. Let me just say one other thing about this spectral density. If I pass it by the intermediate number of particle states, it has a rather nice form where it goes like this, basically, where lambda is the Tuft coupling, n e over lambda to the power of 6. E over n lambda to the power of 6. And so for those that have familiar a little bit with the classicalization story, this is fits in with that story, because what it's saying is that if I'm scattering, there it's usually a phrase for scattering, but if I'm scattering n particles, you can think of, so if you scatter some particles with energy total E, energy E, you preferentially produce the state in which the outgoing particles have energy E over n. And so you can think of, let's think about E over particles with energy E over n, which are now weakly coupled, which are scattering, what's the coupling constant in this theory? The theory's got one of lambda Q interactions, but you always have to have two of them. So the effective coupling constant is E over n lambda to the power of 6. And the Tuft coupling constant for that system is this thing. And what we see coming out of the spectral density is precisely the Tuft coupling constant associated with the Galilean. And my last point then is that in this theory, once you've weakened this notion of the distribution, then it can be the case that even when you look in, remember that we're going back in a background state, at tree level, there were solutions which were superluminal, but it can be the case that in those particular coherent states, that for this theory, it is nevertheless true, so alpha, let me call that the coherent state, is nevertheless true that this statement is true. That this thing indeed goes to zero when x minus y squared goes to infinity outside the light cone. But I haven't got to that, so I'll have to leave it at that. But my conjecture then is that, and of course this is speculative, but that all Galilean theories really are not local field theories, and that explains the contradiction with so on. But they can be viewed as non-local field theories in this sense as they're not tempered distributions and so on. So I'll leave it at that.